Hello and welcome to Poetry Nonstop. I'm Patrick Widdis and I'm joined on this episode by Paul Wellings, better known as the Antisocial Worker. You might have heard him recently sharing a poem on the Norfolk Poets series, and it's great to have him on for a proper chat. You're going to hear some amazing stories from his prolific career, more of his poetry and some ideas to get creative yourselves. Here he is with a poem to kick us off.
This one, War in a Ghetto. It's a true story. I'm a peaceful hustler, but I've seen another life for some. Ego and money chasing. People doing silliness. Pure vanities. Don't talk about urban regeneration if you can't regenerate mindsets. If you don't prove yourself, you're going to get stepped on. Only the para survive. You can't be a pussyhole on Hackney Road. Not that manner, too hood. Postcode ghetto wars. Allow it, bro, allow it. We go again. There's inherited beef. One minute he goes to the shop with his mate. Next minute he's been stabbed by an op. Every other day, 5-0 knock at his door. He'd like to go back in time. He knows that everything is going to end up. He's here in his yard. It's safe. It's calm. It's not safe out there. Exploited, trafficked, keeping thugs sweet. The government only cares about itself. They're not talking to people in the blocks or council estates. They're talking to people in Chelsea or Mayfair. He gave up on himself in the borough. Like, this is the life. You don't need to look for it because it's right there. No one carries a shank for fashion. It's not for show. For him, it's for defence. If the time came, he'd be 100% prepared to use it. It's either him or them. He'd rather be in jail than dead. That's the grim reality. He feels like Superman until it's time to run. He's got his squads back. People get shot at, wet up. People are dying. He's a soldier. If a soldier can do it, he can do it. It's another East Side story. His days are filled with hypervigilance, bear violations, anxiety attacks, and super paranoia. Bagger nitties, crack fiends, laughing hyenas, bullies, snitches, slipping, snakes, neeks, psychopaths on the front line. You don't know what you're going to hear. Who's going to die next? He doesn't like speeding cars, going the wrong way. Leng tints, black cars, dodgy license plates. He wants to leave. It's a sad life. There's nothing to be glamorized. Children die. Everyone wants to leave. It's just about timing. Dealing food, roadman running from the Jakes. He can't be doing this no more. But as long as there is drugs and poverty, we'll always have a gang problem. He likes his probation officer. She's like family. He can't even argue with her. Magistrates give him a 12-month referral order under the supervision of a youth offending team. He's enrolled in college. He seems to be turning his life around. No more county lines, no more stab vests for the ghetto youth. Thank you.
That was the antisocial work of a poem there that pulls no punches. Where did that poem come from?
It came from people that I knew in East London. It was a story that I was told, and I'm a pacifist myself. I'm a peaceful person, but in London, violence is all around you. You know, I've witnessed knife crime, I've witnessed robberies. It's everywhere. You know, you cannot escape violence in London, sadly.
Yeah, so is that where you grew up?
Yeah, well, I was born in the London New Towns, which is where all the East Enders moved out to, the so-called Cockney rejects, as they were. So I was born in, like, Harlow, Hemel Hempstead, grew up in those areas. Moved to the East End when I was 16 years old because of family problems. And I ended up in a hostel in Dock Street, in down near Wapping, on the River Thames, quite near Tower Bridge. And in that hostel, which I didn't really want to be at, but circumstances dictated I was there, there were, you know, sex workers, there were drug addicts, there were homeless people, there were criminals, and there were people with mental health problems as well. So it was a very tough place to sort of grow up. But there was an amazing amount of unity in that diversity. It was, we all stuck together, and there are actually, you know, they were friends of mine at the time, and we did a lot of very interesting things together, you know, to try and break ourselves out of that that reality, really, to try and escape from that.
Yeah, it's not an easy thing to do.
No.
You've gone on to have much better outcomes than a lot of people caught up in that kind of life.
No, absolutely. I mean, I come from a working class family, but it was an educated working class family. We always had books in our house. My dad was a PE teacher, so he gave me a real love of sport, and my mum was like a miner's daughter, so she gave me that sort of socialist side and that sort of class identity, as it were. So I got my politics from my mum, and I got my love of sport and my love of books from my dad. I was never into traditional poetry. It always turned me off. I mean, I took A-levels and I did Wordsworth, The Preludes, which nearly put me off poems for life. I actually loathed that, as I said earlier, with a passion. But then punk came along, and John Cooper Clarke really got me into poetry. And as I said earlier, I'm lucky to have shared a stage with him and all my heroes, you know, who I'm not fit to lace their trainers, but I've played with Linton Kwesi Johnson, another hero of mine, at the Calabash Literary Festival in Jamaica, which was incredible. And I actually did a version as an encore of John Cooper Clarke's I Want to Be Yours, and the Jamaican crowd went crazy for that. Something to do with, there's a line in it about hair gel or something, which they really identified with as people with afro hair. It's something that my wife's Jamaican, so she's, her hair is a big part of a Jamaican's life, really. And the other guy I was lucky to share a stage with as another hero of mine is Benjamin Zephaniah, because he was on the same record label as me. He was on Arewa Records, which is based in Peckham. It's the Mad Professor's label, and Mad Professor being the UK's leading dub producer. And we did an album as the Anti-Social Workers Collective. There were three punks who just went in, and we were just spitting bars over the top of the Mad Professor's dub rhythms. And we made an album called Positive Style that John Peel really liked on Radio 1. He played that a lot. And
wow.
We toured with Peter Tosh, who was Bob Marley's partner, and Ica Mouse, who's another reggae icon. Reggae is a massive part of my life. I've always been a huge reggae head. I was going to Notting Hill Carnival at 16 years old, listening to the sound systems, you know, people like Coxon Sound, which they just, I don't know if you saw recently on Pride, the Pride of Britain Windrush special, there was a big tribute to Lloydie Coxon, who runs the Coxon Sound, because he was the first guy to create a sound system in this country. And that's where this whole grime scene came from, really. Grime has Jamaican influences. It's like the new punk, but it's also, it's got reggae influences, it's got hip-hop influences, it's got rap influences, trap influences, drill influences. So it's very much a music of black origin grime. But I've been into grime for 20 years when it first started. I just walked into my friend's record store in East London, and he said, "Paul, have a listen to this." And he played me this track by Stussy called Dollar Sign, and I'd never heard anything like it before. And from then on, I really got into grime quite heavily, and say grime is a big part of what I do. I mean, I don't know if I've invented the term grime poetry. I've never heard anyone else call themselves a grime poet before. I thought I need to have an identity, because I'm a bit different to, you know, the run-of-the-mill poets. So I said I'd just call myself a grime poet, because that's been the biggest influence of my life. I mean, the closest, I suppose, to my style would be someone like George the Poet, who's a much better poet than me, I hasten to add. But he comes probably from that tradition as well, I'd say. Inner city London, you know, music of black origin, yeah.
Seems like from the early days you surrounded yourself with very influential people. How did that come about, and how did they influence you?
Yeah, I'm just very lucky, really. I just happened to be in the right place at the right time. You know, with the Mad Professor, I was working as a journalist on a local paper just outside North London. And I interviewed this local band, and they said they'd been down to the Mad Professor's studios in Peckham. And they said, you know, I think you should go down there, because just do a demo with him. And we were just forming this kind of punk collective called the Anti-Social Workers. This was in the early 80s, and I was only a teenager, and I said, 19 years old, I said, right, okay, I'll go down to the Mad Professor studios. And it was incredible. It was his studios were in a basement of this sort of flat in Peckham, and the sounds were incredible. I mean, he had some of the top Jamaican musicians on the album. He had Leroy Hall Smouth Wallace, who's in the film Rockers, if you've ever seen that. It's a sort of iconic Jamaican reggae film. He's the lead actor in it, but he's known as one of the best drummers in Jamaica, and he was on our album. And as I said, John Peel picked up on it, and we got in the NME and Sounds, and we got on the front page of Sounds music paper, and we toured with, I don't know if I said this earlier, but we toured with Peter Tosh, Bob Marley's writing partner, and we toured with Eka Mouse as well, who's an iconic figure in reggae music as a toaster, one of these guys that chats on the mic. And we did, with Peter Tosh, we did the London Dominion Theatre, which is an incredible venue to play, you know. Some of the reggae purists didn't like us. We had a few plastic cups thrown at us because, obviously, we weren't exclusively white, but we were predominantly white. We had three white guys. We had a black guy, a mixed-race woman, and a white woman as well. So it was quite a big collective. But because we were punks and we were kind of not necessarily speaking in Jamaican patois, the purists didn't like us so much as a support act. But, you know, we can take that, you know.
So as well as a poet, you've been described as a MC, freedom fighter, DJ, journalist. What did you want to be when you started out?
I always wanted to be a writer, funnily enough, because English was the only thing I was any good at school. I mean, I was rubbish at maths. I don't know if I'm number dyslexic, but I was absolutely useless at maths. My dad tried to drum it into me because him being a PE teacher, just couldn't take it. My late brother sadly passed away a couple of years ago, my younger brother. He was a natural academic. He did really well. You know, he went to Leeds University, worked at Leeds University as a researcher. Sadly, he died of motor neurone disease about 2 years ago, but he was a natural academic. I wasn't. My mum always said I was trouble, really. You know, she used to say that I was always attracted to the bad boys at school. I'd always bring the most scruffy ragamuffins home with me. You know, the people with the elbows coming out of their jumpers and the snotty-nosed kids. That was me. All the spotty little Herberts, I would be bringing back home. And I suppose I was always attracted to that rebellious kind of anti-establishment life, you know, which is partly to do with my politics, but also to do with the environment I grew up in, which where everyone was a hustler. Everyone had some kind of hustle, some sort of side hustle, whether it be something horrible like drugs or something like, I don't know, shoplifting. I mean, I'm not proud of this, but I mean, I was shoplifting at the age of 10 years old, which is really, really quite sad, really.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I've got children myself, and, you know, I'd be mortified if my kids had been arrested for shoplifting at 10. But I was brought back home to my parents' house by a policeman. Well, in London, we call the feds. You know, they brought me back, and my dad grounded me for about a month, and they were really mortified about it. I sort of brought shame on the family a little bit, you know, because they were working class people, but they liked to present the fact they were respectable, you know. My mum would scrub the steps on the front door, and, you know, we always had a clean house, we always had food on the table. You know, we didn't have a great deal of money, but we had a lot of love. You know, there was a lot of love in our family, you know.
Yeah, coming up to the present, you've recently done a new album.
Yeah, it's really weird because as you mentioned all the things that I've been described as by various right journalists and people. You know, I have been a hustler, a freedom fighter. I worked on a pirate radio station for a while, playing a lot of underground black music. And I was lucky to play with some really good DJs at the time. One of whom has been cancelled, actually, which that's Tim Westwood. We don't mention him.
Right.
So obviously he's obviously a rather unsavoury character. But I work with people like Pete Tong. Obviously he's gone on to massive things. Maxi, excuse all the name dropping, by the way. I hate name droppers, as I said to the Pope recently. But Jazz from Faithless. He was on our station. So yeah, I worked with some really good people, and we played in places like the North Peckham estate, which is a no-go estate to anyone who knows South London quite well. I mean, postmen wouldn't go there, doctors wouldn't go there, ambulance crews wouldn't go there. It's a really dodgy estate, and we had a radio station based on that estate. We had guys on the roof protecting the aerials because rival stations would try and chop the aerials down. And I used to turn up with a sports bag full of vinyl with a baseball bat inside it, just for my own protection. Not that I'm a violent person at all, but you know, you had junkies on the stairwells, you had pit bulls running wild on this estate, you know, it stunk of piss everywhere. It was a really dodgy area, let's just say that. So anyway, yeah, so I did all that. I did pirate radio, and the anti-social workers, we kind of split up, you know, the usual cliche about musical differences or whatever. And I did a lot of writing. I was writing for, when I left the local paper, the Beds and Bucks Observer, where, as I said earlier, I was writing about cats up trees and WI reports and all that, but music, and I was doing interviewing local bands, and I was doing film reviews. I've always loved movies, and I was writing about sport because I've got a great love of sport. And as a result of that, I sold some stories to the national press. So I got some stories printed in the Mirror and the Evening Standard, and I ended up doing shifts for them in Fleet Street. So I was really lucky to be in Fleet Street during... the most important thing is I worked for the NME, the New Musical Express. That was the big break for me, which was, as Nick Hornby describes, the best job in the world, but the worst paid job in the world. It was pretty poor pay, but I mean, I interviewed most of my heroes, and some of whom let me down, sadly, but shattered the illusions. And also I wrote books. I wrote some books on popular culture, which I got published by the Progressive Press, which is like a socialist imprint. It's an independent thing. Tony Benn had a book published with them. So my first book was called I'm a Journalist, Get Me Out of Here, which was about my life on the Mirror and the NME. And then I followed that up with a thing called Spend It Like Beckham, which was all about the greed, vanity and broken dreams in football. Because I'm a big West Ham supporter and an England supporter. The new England, I hasten to add, the more sort of diverse England team we've got now. And then the next one after that was Sex, Lines and Videotape. That was a book about cult film quotes, and that got printed in the Independent. That got in the Independent magazine on the front cover, so that was pretty good. That got a few sales. And then the last book I put out was about that was called The Divine Comedians, and that was all about radical stand-up comedy. And again, it was mainly quotes, because that seemed to be quite a good seller. But I never made massive money out of writing. I've never made a lot of money out of anything I do. But I was doing poetry from the age of 19 with the anti-social workers, and I was part of that ranting poetry scene, which was very big in the early 80s. People like Attila the Stockbroker played with them. People like Seething Wells. Was on a par with some of the benefit gigs that were going at the time, the miners' benefits, the dockers' benefits, the Wapping dispute. I mean, I was personally involved in that because I was a union organiser. So I was personally involved in the Wapping dispute against Murdoch, where the police were charging with batons on horseback, and they were battering women and children. I've never seen such extreme violence in my life. So I've actually written a poem about the London police. I love the police where I live now, because I've moved to the East Coast now, and Norfolk's my adopted home, and I love Norfolk, and I love the community policing in Norfolk, but the London Metropolitan Police is another thing altogether. As it has been pointed out by police officers who've worked in the Met, it is institutionally racist, sexist, homophobic, and they call themselves the biggest gang in London, and they are. And I've had really bad experiences with the police. I've been in cells overnight just because I was hanging out with black mates of mine who they automatically assumed were drug dealers and all this nonsense. I've had black friends of mine who run successful businesses, you know, good entrepreneurial people who have been like pulled by the police in cars 5 times in a week. Now, if that was a white guy in that car, it wouldn't happen, you know.
It's
blatant.
Got a lot of it, you know, a few decades ago, and it's still not stopped now, I imagine.
No, absolutely not. I'd say it's just as bad.
Well, it's been amazing life and career full of colour, very eventful. What would you say to those who are inspired by what you've done to be more creative and do more writing?
Well, I spoke to you earlier. I mean, I even wrote a poem on the way here on the bus. Just sometimes I get an idea in my head. And I always have a notepad next to my bed at night in case I get ideas for little rhyming couplets. And some of my stuff is freeform, some of it is beats and rhymes. I mean, my album, the new album that's just come out that you mentioned earlier, that came out last year, it's Anti-Social Worker Singular. So there was about a 40-year gap between the Anti-Social Worker's Positive Style album that John Peel liked with the Mad Professor. And I just suddenly thought, when I saw what Boris Johnson was up to with all the Partygate and stuff, because my dad died of COVID, and I'll never forgive Johnson for all the Partygate business. I just thought, Johnson is such a blatant charlatan, you know, such a liar and a cheat. I thought, I've got to write something about this. And I came out of so-called, musical retirement. I was still writing poems all the time, and I was still doing, you know, open mics and stuff. But I thought, I'm going to put an album out. And I met this guy, I've known him, he's a friend of mine, I've known him about 15 years. He's a rapper called Le Magnifique, who's based in northwest London, or North Wheezy, as they call it. And he said to me, why don't you come in the studio? I've got some really interesting, or, you know, alternative hip-hop beats. You can do some of your poetry over the top. I think it would really work. So I went in the studios in Kilburn, in North London, northwest London. And he promised me some lovely beats, and there were some really interesting hip-hop beats we did. But it wasn't just hip-hop beats. It was quite an eclectic, diverse mix of stuff. And I just did it in the studio, on the spot. I hadn't practiced at all. I just heard the beat, thought, yeah, I can do something over that. And I did the whole album in one take. I literally didn't do a second take. You know, the beat came in, did my poem, bang. The next one came in, did another poem, bang. And we did 15. And it's only £9. It's 15 bangers, as I call them, on it. It's on m1music.com, which is my friend Le Magnifique's record label. But he put a few grand up for the album. And he said to me, once we've broken even on this, then we'll go halves and all the money. So, you know, in true sort of socialist spirit, he's quite a left-wing guy. And so far, we've virtually broken even on it. And once we break even, then he'll probably let me back in the studio next year and I'll do a second album. But that album's called Militant Business and Grime Poetry. Very lucky that it got played on the specialist shows on Radio 1, One Extra, Six Music. Didn't lead to a massive increase in sales. We got some sales out of it. But I just don't think people want to buy music anymore. Everyone wants free downloads. You know, there's not a lot of music. We don't put it out digitally for that reason. We put it out as an old school CD because we thought that's the only way we're going to make any kind of money out of it.
Great, yeah. We'll put the link up and... And have a bit more inspiration for everyone. So you've got a poem and a writing exercise.
Yeah. Yeah, there's an interesting story behind this one. It's my son and I. We were sitting in the east, near my home in the East Coast. And I said to him, he might have said to me, I can't remember now. But we said, let's both write a poem about the sea, because we were literally sitting on the sand looking out to the sea, in 5 minutes, and we'll both write a poem. And this is what I come up with. He won't let me read his one because that's personal to him, but this one is called Sea, and I say you wrote it in 5 minutes staring out to sea. So C-S-E-A. I'm staring at the turquoise sea, listening to DJ Norman J, MBE, walking to the show, end of the pier, pissed up punters enjoying their beer, getting a homemade gelato ice cream. You scream, we all scream for ice cream. Or a crepe cooked in a caravan by a cool hipster who calls me man. Running through the pebbles to the sand, watching lovers walking hand in hand. Deciding with kids to skim some stones, getting away from reality and the moan and groan. Seeing the ebb and flow of the tide, wedding photographers catch the blushing bride. At the end of the prom is an art gallery, seeing surrealism, modern art for free. Surfing dudes trying to catch a wave. Coffee shop running an outdoor rave. Crabs scuttle from swooping seagulls. Anglers catching mackerel, life's never dull. They've even got their own Banksy, satirising gentrification for me. There's no place on earth I'd rather be than the gorgeous scenery of the salty sea. Thank you.
Nice, like it's a very recognisable scene, but also sort of personal lines and observations there as well. Mm. And I like how you're writing with your son. It's nice to do those little writing exercises with other people.
Yeah.
I have a few friends in different parts of the world, and we regularly get together over Zoom and we do writing exercises together, and it's
excellent.
Really fun and sort of really good creative exercise.
No, it is. And you know, my son now is a poet. He comes to the open mic. You've heard one of his poems. My daughter's going to write some poetry for the next open mic in Norwich, which I think is a fantastic event, by the way. Outside of London, the last poet standing at the last pub standing in Norwich, is the best open mic I've ever been to. I mean, there were over 100 people when we were there last time.
Yes.
It was incredible.
Been going from strength to strength, and that last one you were at was the biggest and the best one so far.
Yeah, I mean, the waves of applause, they were so appreciative. I mean, I've just felt 9 feet tall after I'd done my set.
Yeah.
I only did 3 poems, but it was incredible. I loved every second of it, and they were just so inclusive, such nice, kind people. You know, they're my type of people, creatives, you know.
Yeah,
no idiots.
And so what's the exercise?
Yeah, so I suggest that people should, you know, obviously not everyone lives by the sea, so you could live in a town, you could be near a park, you could be near a forest, you could be near a woodland. Maybe just get out to nature in some shape or form and just challenge you and a friend to write a poem in 5 minutes about what you see around you. And you'll be really surprised with the results. I was certainly surprised by that one. And I thought my son did an incredible poem as well. We both marked each other. Obviously, we're a bit biased. We both gave each other 8 out of 10 for our efforts.
Yeah, I'd say have fun with it. You produced an amazing poem there.
Thank you.
But it's not necessarily the idea to come up with a finished poem.
No.
Just get writing, your pen moving and your mind working, and have fun with it, and it could grow into something bigger after that.
And I would say be true to yourself as well. I mean,
absolutely.
I like Luke Wright a lot as a poet. I've seen him a couple of times. I think he's a really interesting poet. And I'm certainly not hating on Luke Wright, but sometimes when he talks about street life and stuff, it does sound a little bit phony to me, because obviously he went to private school. I'm not holding that against him. He can't help where his parents sent him to school. But I think be true to yourself and write about the things you love and write about the things you know. I mean, I know, sadly, in a way, I know quite a bit about London street life because I've been through it. And it's not something to be glamorised at all, but it is quite evocative, some of the stuff you see, in terms of character building and things like that.
Well, yes, I mean, everything you've been telling us, your next book should probably be an autobiography.
Well, I did write this autobiography. It's only a humble little thing called I'm a Journalist, Get Me Out of Here, which does talk about my early life, but it does talk about getting into journalism. But it's essentially a book about journalism, my love of journalism and journalists. I mean, I was very lucky to work with some of the greatest journalists in this country on the Mirror. I mean, I worked with Paul Foote, who was a really good investigative reporter. Again, you know, he was a private school guy, but he turned his back on his background. And I admired him even more for that, because he took up the cause for the downtrodden and the oppressed. And I've got to admire him for that, because he rejected his whole background. A bit like Tony Benn, he did the same thing. But I also worked with John Pildrew, who's one of the greatest investigative reporters ever, you know. But investigative journalism is on the way out now, because this whole monopoly of newspapers by one group, it takes over all these newspapers, and it reduces the editorial staff down to a skeleton staff just to maximise profits. And they don't send reporters out on stories anymore. A lot of reporters now are not telling truth to power. They are actually just reproducing press releases without questioning it, which I think is not journalism. That's just, you know, copy-taking, really.
Yeah. Well, how about we finish off with another poem?
Yeah, let's do that. I'll tell you what, I mean, I don't think it's a particularly good poem, but I literally wrote this on the bus coming here.
Great, yeah.
And I've never done it before, so let's do this one. It's called Tony Montana. And if anyone's seen the film Scarface with Al Pacino, which is sort of an iconic film for anyone in the rap community or the hip-hop community or even the grime community, it's such an iconic film. It's called Tony Montana, and this is about someone that I used to know who was quite a nasty cocaine dealer. And it's called Tony Montana. You fuck with me, you fuck with the best. You're a Charlie Shotter and a fucking pest. You think you're London's answer to Tony Montana, yet you prey on vulnerable people in the manor. You've got the mental health of Tony Soprano. To save your skin, you snitch to the popo. Gack makes you an arrogant motherfucker, a user, a loser, a big-time sucker. You think the white means the world is yours. You're just another two-bit rebel without a cause, getting high on your own supply mistake. Why didn't you stick to the wake and bake? Robbing from your nan to support your habit, but you'll be the next victim of a direct hit. Your selfish actions cause misery to families, just so you can earn a few extra peas. Your shit is always treaded to fuck, but hopefully soon you'll run out of luck. You've no loyalty to fam in the hood. Very soon you'll be topped off for good. Thank you.
That was The Antisocial Worker, and his album Militant Business and Grime Poetry is out now. Go old school and buy a CD. You can find details of that and everything else from today's show on poetrynonstop.com. Finally, I'd like to share my response to Paul's writing prompt. I did this in the Botanic Gardens in Cambridge, a beautiful haven for plants and wildlife in the city that I've been visiting since my early childhood. It was an ideal location to spend a few minutes writing and appreciating nature, and this is exactly what I wrote in 5 minutes. It has not rained after all, but this mossy bench retains an easy dampness. If only life was as easy as ducks, swimming among the red and yellow leaves, beneath summer blue skies and a crisp winter breeze. What's that bird song? Do they know it's closing time in a couple of hours, when the cyclist with the big bell does the rounds, clearing the meandering paths of human footprints, before gates lock, sun sinks towards the horizon, and for nature, the fun really begins. Now, I wouldn't say that was a finished poem. I wouldn't normally share it without a bit of redrafting, but I'm quite pleased with a lot of the images I've got there, and the way that elements of summer and winter combine during the autumn months. The thing that really surprised me was the cyclist. It was only when I started writing that I remembered that, because it's a very large park, when it's about to close, someone goes round on a bike ringing a big bell to let everyone know that they have to leave. So overall, that was a really nice exercise and a nice way to spend 5 minutes. And I hope you will be inspired to try this yourselves. And as always, do share your results. You can polish it up first. You don't have to share your 5 minute draft. You can send your poems to poetrynonstop@gmail.com or via the website poetrynonstop.com. I'll be back with more poetry soon, so please subscribe and stay tuned. Until next time, thank you for listening and keep writing.